If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay. Your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. It is now the 11th night and there is quite a roster for this evening. In 2 hours' time it'll be Garrod Murphy from Ireland, then it'll be Ava, and then it'll be the Distributist. But first, one of the most popular guests each year, I'm here with the Jolly Heretic, Ed Dutton. Ed, welcome back to Millennial.
Hello. Good to be here again. Have you had a good year?
Yes, I've been working hard on Substack.
Excellent.
So, yes, I've been enjoying that, yes. Building it up gradually, hoping that it will take, you know, that I'll be able to make a decent living from it eventually. But in the meantime, it's a nice body of work that's developing, I think. And then, of course, I do this at the end of each year. So, yes, it's been a decent year, yes. I know that you've been busy as well. We were talking before we went on air about three different books that you've worked on this year.
Yeah, well, I had this book. This book published in May, Woke Eugenics: How Social Justice is a Mask for Social Darwinism. And then I'm just finishing a book which will come out next year, which is a biography of Jonathan Bowden that some viewers may have heard of. And then I'm also doing a book on Jim Watson, the guy that discovered the structure of DNA. So that's what's been going on research wise. I've got a couple of others that I'm still working on, but they won't be out for a while. So yeah, that's what's been going on.
All right, and we'll concentrate on woke eugenics. So this was percolating this time last year, but it developed, and you published the book this May. So
that's right. With my co-author JOA Rayner Hills, the squire at the village in which the Jolly Heretic Public House is based, and with whom I also wrote an earlier book called "The Past as a Future Country: The Coming Conservative Demographic Revolution," and it really carries on where that left off, which is that basically we realised we were walking in Wimbledon Village one day in October 2023, making our way to a pub called the Dog and Fox. And an idea sort of, well, Ollie started talking about it, and then we bounced it back and forth, and then we came to a realization, which is that you shouldn't, an epiphany, although I think it was more perhaps his idea than mine, but this is that maybe we shouldn't be that angry with the next blue-haired, weirdo, crazy woman, with tattoos, who's woke, that comes across our path. Maybe she's actually doing Darwin's work. Maybe she's actually rescuing the European race. Maybe she's actually, this woke woman, the ultimate ethno-nationalist who is sacrificing her own genetic interests for the good of preserving her ethnic group. And thus, maybe ironically, people that oppose her, people that are anti-woke, these GB News types, they're actually the people that are destroying European man. That they should just let her get on with the natural process. We came to the conclusion that basically wokeness, yes, these kinds of people, yeah. Wokeness is a selection event, and it's an adaptation, a group level adaptation that European man appears to have developed to ensure that he remains genetically healthy across time, that he survives, that and he doesn't become so unhealthy that when civilization collapses, as it inevitably will, basically he's wiped out to a tiny little amount of people that end up marrying into other races, or when the next Graham Hancock type meteor or whatever hits the Earth, we're not so unhealthy that we're all just wiped out. The European man is preserved by wokeness, because basically we were selecting until, you know, as we've talked about on here another year, you know, until the Industrial Revolution, you have this fitness factor. And that is, they're all intercorrelated, being conservative, being religious, being genetically mentally healthy, being genetically physically healthy. They're all genetically correlated. They're a fitness factor. And that has collapsed. And so we as a people have become so unhealthy, so deracinated, so totally unhealthy. Something has to hit in to permit the race, and indeed the species, to survive across time. And that is wokeness. Because eventually we become so unhealthy that the ideas and views of the sick, i.e. that you shouldn't have children, that you should mutilate your children, that you should go on sex strike, all this stuff, materialism, all this, those ideas become the culture. And when that happens, you're pushing people along a maladaptive roadmap of life. And the only people that are going to resist that environment, that are not going to be sucked into the death cult of wokeness, are the genetically resistant, the genetically fit. And so therefore, everybody else just dies off, and you end up with these genetically fit people that survive the process. Not only that, but those people are going to be intelligent, because as when you control for intelligence, the big predictor of fertility is that you are conservative and religious, and the heritability is about 60% genetic, and the big predictor of sterility is that you're liberal and that you're left wing and that you're an atheist. And so Rokas is creating a group that is genetically fit. Once again, a race, as it were, a subgroup, an ethnic group that is genetically fit once again, such that essentially the race survives across time. If wokeness doesn't hit in, if you don't get these mutant woke people, you don't get that reaction. So you potentially just carry on becoming, because remember, we're in a situation where we're selecting against intelligence and we're selecting for physical poor health. Physical poor health predicts having children. And so if this goes on forever, or if this goes on continuously, then eventually you get to a point where everyone's so unhealthy that they're all wiped out, or everyone's so unhealthy that they can't find, they can have very few children, they're from having children, you're just devastated and you're destroyed. This stops that process. So
it's kind of like a boil that forms, and all the pus from the body is going into the boil, and then it's sort of isolated there. So then that can be excised, as it were.
I'm not sure. But you may well be right. I'm not quite sure about the way that boils operate. But perhaps so. Yeah. It's that's quite interesting. I'd have to look into that to see if the metaphor works. But basically, it's something like that. The point is that you get all these mutants. We get loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of them. That build up and up and up and up and up. But they are in a context in which they are being pushed along an adaptive roadmap of life by the traditional culture. That has flipped over in the 60s. We're pushed along a maladaptive roadmap, increasingly so. And so what that means is it means, first of all, then, if you look at what their policies do, first of all, their policy, what they're doing, they're basically pressurizing women, more intelligent women in particular, to not have children. They are huge amounts of money spent on welfare and things like that. And so what they're doing is they're bringing down woke policies, force down intelligence. So they force us back to a situation in which there are harsher Darwinian conditions. But who is going to be wiped out by those conditions? It's people like them. The people that are genetically healthy, and that correlates with being conservative, with being religious and so on, those people will be much more likely to survive those harsh Darwinian conditions. But they won't. They're the ones that they're creating their own destruction by bringing down civilization in that sense. But secondly, they're doing more than that. It's more rapid than that. They're literally creating, as well as making us stupider, they're creating a culture which will collapse civilization. They're creating a culture which is only going to be resisted by those that are genetically highly physically and mentally healthy. And then more than that, if you look at what predicts miscegenation, what predicts outbreeding, and the answer is low IQ. So one of the things that's building up is the underclass. The underclass, low IQ, extremely genetically unhealthy, whatever. But wokeness encourages them to outbreed. It literally promotes all the time via its media. Outbreeding is good. Outbreeding is good. Outbreeding is good. So, of course, they will then that unhealthy component of the European population, that just becomes part of the non-white population, of the growing non-white population. And among those that are more intelligent, as I said, the big predictors of breeding are conservatism. So you end up with an intelligent, conservative, religious people who are that for genetic reasons, and you can expect them to kind of break away and create what I've called a kind of neo-Byzantium, and then the ethnic group carries on. But it goes so much, even at the sort of environmental level, there's so much that wokeness is doing to further bring this about. For example, when we were about the same age, when we were young, you had to, there was no internet really, you had to rub along with people. You had to, if you got a girlfriend or something, you'd meet her down the local pub, or you'd meet her at university. Maybe you voted Conservative and she voted Labour, but that didn't seem to matter. It was then. Whereas wokeness has created this incredible polarization where if you dissent from their views, you're evil. And what that has caused is people who are, as it were, conservative and whatever based, you know, genetically, to find themselves, to get together into subgroups in a way that was never previously the case, in a way that was never, the ability to do it was lower because there wasn't so much internet and materialism and ways of doing it, but also just the desire to do it was lower, the need to do it was lower. So you're getting people who are genetically highly conservative and forcing them together, creating a situation where the offspring will be likewise. So you're creating a genetic polarization effect, which is going to make this difference even more pronounced. You're also doing other things, like you're collapsing law and order. You're creating a narco-tyranny. What does that do? It brings out people's instincts. People's instincts are to be conservative. People's instincts are to be right-wing, to be religious. These are what comes out when you're under stress, your instincts. So in a sense, among those kinds of conservative people that would have the possible inclination to be like that, you're making them more conservative, more religious, more likely to find each other. And there are many, you're doing things to piss them off all the time. You're making them feel humiliated. Now, there's two, you know, with things like, portraying important historical figures as black or whatever it happens to be. There's two reactions to that. One is the reaction they want, which is that you become depressed and you just lost the point and you stop trying. But the other is that it makes you all the more desirous to fight. And so therefore it heightens the degree to which you're going to get the development of a subculture, basically based white intelligent people, that will break away and keep civilization going. So, as far as I can see, wokeness can be seen in that sense as a group level selection event, that if it didn't
or
come,
an evolutionary shit test.
Yes. It is, but it's a shit test that we're doing to ourselves. So we have become like the mice in that. Well, to be fair, it was almost certainly scientifically faked. But in that famous experiment, the mouse utopia, and they get to a point where none of them want to have babies. They're so genetically messed up and environmentally messed up that none of them want to have babies and they die out. Now, I don't know. I mean, I get the impression that there are a number of other universes where that didn't happen, where actually what I'm proposing happened, which is that you find a way of getting through, i.e. all of the people that can be, all of the mice, there is the system of mouse utopia is a selection event whereby there are some mice that for genetic reasons are resistant to this chaos that's been set off by mouse utopia. So you get eventually they're the ones that sort of carry on. And I think that's what you're getting with wokeness. We are so unhealthy that being that unhealthy has within it the seeds. It won't go on forever. It won't go on until every single living person is so unhealthy that nobody can have babies anymore and we die out. That won't happen. Instead, what will happen is that because we are a cultural species, the mutants change the nature of the culture, take over the culture, and then resistance to that culture becomes a selection event, and it's a selection event for health. And that's all Darwin cares about, is that the species remains healthy across time, even if there are fluctuations. There are studies, I mean, it's not for the same reasons, but there are studies, this is found in all animals that we know of. You get this situation where you get a small group of them, they're genetically closely related, and they're healthy. You let the amount build up, there's loads of them, they're less healthy, and then they collapse down, even independent of the development of plagues. They just naturally collapse because it's been theorized that they only want to have, like if it was with fruit fly, then the fruit fly female will hang out. She will wait for Mr. Right fruit fly. And she's less likely to find him because there's loads and loads of fruit fly now, and only some of them are healthy. And so as a result, she doesn't have any babies at all. And so then the fruit fly population collapses down. It's healthy again. Off we go. So that was what would happen across time. I wonder if it might not happen with the Japanese, because their gene pool is so small. That is there enough sort of psychopathy and stuff in the gene pool for woke people to be thrown up? There's no evidence that they have anything similar in Japan. There is evidence that they have the people that just drop out. They have these herbivore males that just can't be bothered to just stop trying. I wonder how, there's no evidence that of something like, because they're so ethnocentric and things like this, there's no evidence of wokeness taking over their culture, really. But anyway, that's what I've been looking at in woke eugenics.
It's funny that you say all this, because I was just thinking last night, for some reason, as I was going to sleep, that this occurred to me, that the drive towards miscegenation, the propaganda, I believe it's about 5% of white people who miscegenate now. But let's be generous and say it's 10%. Then the propaganda to encourage them to do that couldn't really get any more pervasive than it currently is. I don't think. I don't know how it could be more pervasive.
Well, you just already never show anything other than mixed-race couples on television.
Yeah, I mean, that's the norm on TV. It's the norm in advertising. You almost never see white girl, white boy. So the point is, it couldn't get much more pervasive than it is. So probably the 10%, let's say, 10% of white people who miscegenate, probably it's not going to get any higher than that. But then that means that the 10% who miscegenate, they've done it. So in the next generation, they won't be... the ones who were going to do it have already done it now, or will do it in the next few years.
Yes.
And thereafter, it will be white people who passed that test. So probably in the next generation, it'll be less than 10% who miscegenate. Less.
To some extent, that's true. But on the other hand, there will be mutant people that will be born in the next generation, and they will do it like de novo, as it were. But I recently actually wrote something on this, because I wrote something on the jollyheretic.com, my Substack, on the murder of this poor little girl, this Sarah Sharif. And one of the things that occurred to me was that the fact that she was mixed race, she was half Polish and half Pakistani, was germane to what happened to her. There's studies on this. People that are mixed race are more likely to be abused by their parents. Why is that the case? Well, first of all, if you look at who are the kind of people that miscegenate, the evidence in it is two kinds. One is people that like to take risk. There's a study on this. And the other is people of low IQ. And there's a degree to which those two things are interrelated. So basically, it's fast life history strategists. If you are a fast life strategist, your life is live fast, die young, unstable, easy ecology. You are attracted to risk. You are attracted to that which is different, because you could be wiped out any second. So you might as well take the risk. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that if you find someone that's very genetically different from you, then they may well have some unusual gene that could be useful. So you might as well go for them. And thirdly, all you're interested in is fitness. In an environment like that, all you're interested in is that the person is capable of surviving in this unstable, dangerous ecology. And what you therefore select for is fitness. If you're a man, youth and beauty. And you will happily trade race, the genetic similarity, whatever, for youth and beauty. Because let's face it, you're going to have loads of partners. So it doesn't matter. You're going to have loads of partners and loads of children because that's your strategy. Once the environment becomes stable and predictable, that's a very dangerous thing to do, because if you have a small number of children, you have to have a small number of children. If you have a large number and you don't invest in them, they could all just die. So you have to have a smaller number of children with a smaller number of women. That being the case, how do you compensate for the genetic loss of now that you're only having a small number of children? The first answer is that you have children via someone that's relatively genetically similar to you, and thus you've elevated back up your genetic interests. The second thing is you need to be able to nurture these children and bond with them and stuff. You're more likely to do that if you're genetically similar to them. So therefore, you go for somebody unconsciously who is genetically similar to you, such that you can do this. The third thing is that if you're in an environment that is stable and harsh, then you have to find a specific niche, a very specific niche to survive in. You therefore must copulate with people that are genetically similar to you, because if you don't, then the genetic linkages which have made you adapted to that specific ecology and to the pathogens in that specific ecology will break up. So you, and then the child dies. So you have to marry someone genetically similar to you. That's one of the reasons why Muslims engage in cousin marriage. Pathogen load is correlated with cousin marriage. So you can see why there's that psychological difference. And then there's just a difference in intelligence. So, yeah, you I can see your point. And there would be a degree to which you would get, and also, if we're selecting among white people, if the predictor among white people of fertility is that you are religious and that you are conservative, those people are K-strategists. So those people will oppose, will probably not be likely to miscegenate. And then the people that are of low IQ among the whites, they will miscegenate. They're out. So as you say, you would therefore expect it to be a decreasingly popular practice. But then what you get once that happens is, of course, you get the creation of a clan where the people that are mixed race start marrying each other. This is already happening in America. You're getting the rise of the Happer. So normally it's a white American man and he marries a Asian, whatever, Japanese American woman. It started off in Hawaii. That's where the workers were Hapa. And so before long, you have your own race, like with the Hispanics. But yeah, it doesn't go on forever. And you could say that it's for some people, it has status to, but they're promoting it all the time, being mixed race. Mixed race is good. And it has status to do it. So it draws in certain kinds of people. The other problem, though, is they have fertility problems, these mixed race couples. And I've seen studies on this from America and Brazil. They have fertility problems. But the children have mental health problems. They have elevated levels of violence and elevated levels of depression above that of the parent races. And it seems that the reason for that is that those are fast life history strategy traits, and that's what the parents are. So they just pass that on to the kids. But also an element of it could be that you're forcing genes to work together that don't normally work together. And the result of that is that you would expect the woman's immune system to react to the man's sperm as though it was an enemy agent to a greater extent. You would expect fertilization to become more difficult. And that's exactly what happens. They have fertility problems, these couples.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Do you mean that the offspring are less fertile, or do you mean that it's harder for a black guy to impregnate a white woman than a black woman?
Yeah, that. I mean that.
Right. I never knew. I've never heard that before.
Mm. And there's numbers, like about six different studies on this in Brazil, in America, in I think perhaps the UK. Yeah, they have fertility problems. They're more likely to have problems getting pregnant. And then if they do get pregnant, they're more likely to miscarry and things like this. Because the woman's immune system the woman's immune system sees the male the sperm as an enemy agent to be destroyed. But the more genetically different from it the sperm is, then the more it will see it as an enemy, and so the more it will wipe it out. This is why blowjobs are important.
Oh, right. Well, yeah,
if the woman swallows the man's sperm, then it gets her immune system used to the specific nutrients and so forth in his sperm. Mm. And that's why when women do that regularly, then they're more likely to get pregnant by him. And if they don't, they're more likely to miscarry or not get pregnant.
Well, that actually primes her immune system to accept that sperm.
Exactly. That specific sperm is specific. Yeah, exactly.
Right, I see. Well, I won't put up any memes to do with miscegenation. I do have some, but I don't think they're quite appropriate given the turn this has taken.
I'm not saying it's morally wrong to you know, whatever, two people for. I'm not, these people, hope, not hate, whatever. It's not a moral issue. I don't care about that. In fact, there was a chap I knew who was a YouTuber, and he fell out with his two YouTuber friends because he had a sexual relationship with a girl that was half Indian. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. You know, I pass no comment on it. I'm just saying that's what the studies indicate.
Yeah, well, we're only having, this has been a scientific discussion.
Exactly.
I mean, I will say that I don't think it's a good idea to race mix for obvious reasons. Just for obvious reasons. I mean, the child is going to have identity issues. The parent is going to find it difficult to identify with the child. I've seen that countless times.
Well, the parent
white
will
women
be
moaning about this online, that they can't bond with their child. I mean,
but the thing is that the thing that predicts bonding is genetic similarity. And if you look at the research by J. Philippe Rushton, his paper, it was in Nations and Nationalism. I can't remember the title off the top of my head. But anyway, I summarise the research in various books I've done, such as Race, Difference, and Ethnocentrism, and whatever. Even within families, genetic similarity predicts how closely you bond. So people say, oh, your brother and two brothers are 50% the same. No, they're not. They're 50% the same on average. Why? Because the parents are also marrying, selecting for genetic similarity in general. And so therefore, there's doubles of genes and things. And so the consequence is that, no, you might be 55% the same as this sibling and 45% the same as that sibling. It's an average of 50. Now, at that tiny little grain level, it has been found that the siblings that are more genetically similar within a large family are closer. So our grandparents tend to be closer to the grandchildren who are more genetically similar to them. Same kind of thing. And so what you would expect is that if you have these children by someone that's quite genetically different from you, then you will literally feel less close to those children. For that reason alone, independent of the fact that you probably will bond less with them anyway because you're the kind of fast life history strategist that would engage in behavior like that. And the bigger the genetic distance, the more extreme this gets. So if you look at Frank Salter's research on genetic interests, I forget where it was calculated, but it's definitely true. If you have a child, if a white man has a child with a black woman, then that child will only be as similar to the white man as a random member of the white population. So now that's not the case, by the way. If, let's say, a white man has a child with a Japanese woman, the genetic distance is much smaller between the East Asians and the whites than the sub-Saharan Africans and the whites. And so, then you wouldn't be. You'd be much more similar to your child than a random member of the population. But if it's Bantu, that's the... And you could get more extreme than that. I mean, if the world was composed of only English people and Danes, then two random English people in comparison to the Danes would be the equivalent of seventh cousins, such as the small, so, i.e. they're related in about 1700, such as the small difference. If the world was composed of Mbutu pygmies and Australian Aborigines, that's the two most unrelated races. Then two random Mbutu pygmies would be full siblings in comparison. So right. You can see the distances and what it does.
Yeah, and I've actually heard that the Danes and the English, that they're quite genetically similar.
Yeah, that's why it's only seventh cousins.
Yeah. So it's remarkable. The miscegenation, I think there should be more to say about that. I think it's obviously pushed all the time. And I think there's this idea that opposites attract. But it seems that time and time again, in actual life, it's similarity that attracts. Birds of a feather flocking together again and again and again.
It's within certain boundaries. So obviously, too similar, and you risk double doses of harmful mutations. There are some conditions like bipolar depression, where if you have a particular mutant allele in one gene, and a particular mutant allele on another gene, if they have to be together in different genes, in the same person, then that seems to set off bipolar depression. Obviously, in general, your mutational load will be much more likely to be replicated if you marry someone very similar to you. That's why cousin marriage is, in general, a bad idea. There is a degree to which part of one of the reasons for low IQ is harmful double doses in the brain. And there is evidence that cousin marriage reduces IQ on average by about 7 points on average.
Or with each generation.
Compared to the parents, yeah.
That's a huge difference.
Yeah, indeed. But the thing is that in general, it's only on average that it does that. So you're going to get some kids where it doesn't do that. The reason the cousin marriage worked was that under harsh Darwinian conditions, you want to make sure that the genetic linkages that keep you resistant to the pathogens of the ecology don't break up. How can you make sure that's the case? You marry your cousin. That's the first thing. The second thing is that if you want to reduce intermale conflict, then if you marry your cousin, then even if your wife has cuckolded you, then in a community like that where everyone's strongly related, then you're still investing in your offspring, pretty much, aren't you? Thirdly, it helps to create ethnocentrism. So you've got a people where the environment is quite hot. It's basic needs are met, essentially. And so how can you create a cooperative people? Well, one of the ways you do that is by marrying your cousin. And then you end up with this pure line of strongly related people that will be high in positive and negative ethnocentrism, that will be cooperative. And another reason, well, there's this keeping it in the family socioeconomic thing as well, which perhaps is helping it. So you've got all these factors, but the problem is that in an easy ecology, then the child mortality isn't 50%. And so the children that are messed up don't die off. What would happen historically is that it would create these highly healthy people that were strongly adapted to the ecology. And all the people that had the negative side of that would just die off. So now we don't have that. But then also it can't be too distant, because then if it's too distant, then A, as we've seen, there's fertility problems. B, there's problems, it seems, with mental health and violence and things like that. It means that you don't bond enough with your child. You won't feel as close to it. And then it seems that the sweet spot, there was a study on this from Iceland, the sweet spot is your third cousin, your literal third cousin.
So what does that mean?
It's about 1% above the baseline of the population.
So you have the same great-great-great-grandparent. Right, you've got the same great-great-great-grandparent. Right, that's... okay.
Great-great-grandparents. So you share, so in Iceland, because they're all so closely related, it's such a small gene pool, they have an app where, they're chatting each other up in the pub. Well, to be fair, if they go to the pub, they're going to be spending about €15 a pint. But anyway. and then they just quickly check. Oh, you're my second cousin. No, let's not do this. That's how, because it's such a problem in Iceland to have inbreed. Even in Finland, it's a bit of a problem. I mean, two average Finns are much more closely related than two average English people. That's why dwarfism where I live is quite noticeable. It's an issue. I mean, it's not the focus of my book, Woke Eugenics, obviously, but it is one factor that's going on, which is that the environment is telling you to behave in that way, to, as it were, miscegenate. So some people, it's therefore a selection event for those that are prepared to do so. the kind of personality traits or IQ that predicts doing so is removed from the and health level that predicts doing so is removed from the European subgroup. And so
okay. Oh, what's happened? He's gone. He's frozen. Oh, let's see. I hope it's not me. See, that when this happens, you don't know whether it's the person or your own internet connection's fucked up. Let's see. Can anyone type a comment in Odyssey so that I know? Or Rumble? Ah, here he is. Okay, I think he's coming back. I think it's him. It's Ed. Thank you, CCG. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Right, okay. Well, I've forgotten you were in full flow when it happened, so I don't know what...
I was just saying about AI. So the idea, one idea is that civilization will not collapse because we have AI. And so AI will keep the civilization on life support forever. And then will become so deracinated and whatever, and it will become so unhealthy that then eventually when something happens that AI can't deal with, then we're completely destroyed. The counter argument to that is twofold. Well, it's simple. You would expect the religious and the conservative.
Damn it, it's happened again. Oh, shit. We might cut this one short. Oh, hello. Hello again.
Yeah, can you stop?
I think are you asking me to stop my camera?
In again.
Right. Do you ask me to stop my camera?
No, I'm saying, let me just check upstairs because I can imagine my son is sodding about with the computer.
Oh, okay, you do that.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. While he does that, we will.
Henry.
We'll talk about. Let me see this. I'll mute him so that we don't hear that. There we go. Right. I mean, I could look at my. I could put up my miscegenation memes, but they are a bit brutal. Some of them. It's just. I just hate to see it. I think everyone. I think every guy does deep down. Women, I can imagine being a bit more fascinated by the variety and all that. Whereas I think for guys, it's just such an assault on your group that if you've got a pair of balls between your legs, you surely feel that it's wrong, that it's an injustice, that something has been violated, that something is being broken. I always hate it. I hate to see it. Hello, Ed.
What are you talking about, balls?
I was just talking about miscegenation, so this sort of thing.
Oh, right. Yes,
yeah. Okay, so just covering the gap while you were away.
Oh, fair enough. No, my son seems to have gone to bed, so I can't blame him for this. So I don't know. I don't know what it is. I think it might have been my end because my internet did go off. Anyway, never mind. So yeah, it is. It's a very interesting phenomenon. It's under researched as well because it's so taboo. There's not a great deal of research on it. My colleague Michael Woodley of Manee did a paper recently where he argued that from his evidence. The idea that the reason why.
Oh, for fuck's sake, it's happened again. I'm going to ask him to switch off his camera. Unfortunately, I can't do that for him. For some reason, StreamYard doesn't give you the ability to do this stuff as the host. I will ask him to stop his camera, and that should lighten the load on his modem. We'll have to wait for him to come back first. In the meantime, I'll put up another miscegenation meme. Let's see. I mean, I've got so many now. Okay. Well, this one is about mud sharks. Very unfortunate. This kind of thing. I think people must have seen this kind of thing in their own travail, wandering around the internet. I mean, it is grim. So let's see. Here's another one, similar to the other one there. So this kind of thing. I mean, it's just wrong, isn't it? It just doesn't feel right. And you know, I should say, I've got nothing against people who are mixed race. I just think it's a mistake to do it. So there we go. Oh yeah, I would expect most people to agree with me. I've got more of them as well. There's a million where those came from. but of course, when it's, there's also the toll paid thing. It's bad. It's very unfortunate. For any white girl who's inveigled into this, any sane society would be advising against this and used to. I'll tell you an interesting thing actually on this. I was researching about the Empire Windrush, and even then, when was that? 1948. The newspapers even then were talking about. We're laying the ground. I've seen the articles. You can see them now. You can go to these archive websites and see it, and laying the ground for these men to be accepted over here when they arrived. And part of it was pointing out that a lot of them had English brides, war brides, who'd gone back with them to Jamaica and were now wanting to move back to the home country. So, there was laying the groundwork. Welcome back, Ed.
I don't know about this happening, but I've unplugged the modem and plugged it back in again, and that normally sorts things out.
Ah, great, great. If it happens again, I would advise to stop your camera so that it's just your avatar, and that'll put less of a load on the line. Okay, so AI and
look
after things to a certain extent.
It would be itself a selection event. So you could imagine that it would be the people that were more religious that would be more sceptical of this, whereas it would be the people that were less so, that were just hedonistic, basically. And they would be happy to if someone invented a kind of Vanilla Sky. Remember that film Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise? So a kind of a machine where you can just plug yourself into a machine and just live a paradise, basically.
After he's had an injury, hasn't he? He's had a dreadful injury. Yeah. So
they messed up his face. And so you would expect him. You would expect the people that saw life as meaningless and whatever, that they would be more likely to do something like that. Whereas those that had a sense of profundity, i.e., the people, and that is associated. Seeing life as meaningful is associated with mental health, which is itself associated. It not the way round you'd think, i.e., you see it as meaningful and it makes you more mentally healthy. But mentally healthy people just see life as meaningful. And so those people would then pass on their genes. So as I say, it just goes. So I don't think that would stop the selection event that is wokeness. So what I would augur is twofold. One is that there will be a movement back to the right among the elite in the coming 30 years, but that's already happening, which will be in a context of decline and be in a context of large polities breaking up. Because wokeness is helping to create that situation whereby almost like in South Africa, the future would be South Africa, and there would be a small area of highly intelligent, highly healthy, highly religious white people that would break away and that would basically keep civilization going. They would probably be less intelligent than we are now because intelligence is going down. Although it's possible, I did a study with Emil Kierkegaard this year, I think it was published, where we found the only group that is positively selecting for intelligence is white Mormons. Among white Mormons, intelligence is associated with fertility among those people. But in other religious groups, it's not associated with it.
When you say the only group that is positively selecting for intelligence is Mormons, what does that mean? Does that mean that in other groups, people aren't attracted to intelligence.
It means that among, let's say, Catholics, clever Catholics have fewer children than stupid Catholics.
Right. But
among Mormons, that's reversed. Mormons,
I thought that would also be the case with rabbis having six and seven children and so on.
Yes, indeed, it's been argued that one of the factors in the high IQ of the Ashkenazi Jews, well, and other Jews, in fact, relative to their host population, is this idea that the rabbi should be encouraged to have lots of children. There are other factors such as that clever white people tended to marry into Judaism. That's one thing that used to happen. This idea that Judaism only passes through the female line is relatively recent. They only really established it in about the 11th century or 12th century. And there are some Jewish groups that are fine with it, you know, not being through the female line. So there's variation in it, a variation in how strongly it was enforced, things like this. So that is a factor in what's going on with the Mormons. I think it's that they're very community oriented, and so the general view is that you just shouldn't be a drag on the community. You shouldn't be a parasite. It's just wrong. You don't do that, and so you only have the kind of children that you can afford. And they all have quite high impulse control and whatever anyway. Among the Finns, there is some evidence that in general, there is this weak negative correlation between intelligence and how many children you have in Western countries. But in some countries, it's weaker than others. Among Finns, it's particularly weak. IQ is going down in Finland, according to military data. But the studies that I found from the 70s, Finland industrialized later than England. So there's all kinds of reasons why this could be so. But from the 70s in England, we were definitely in dysgenic fertility. And what that's powered by mainly is women. It's women who are more intelligent, having fewer children due to feminism, due to pressuring them to, you know, limit how many children they have or to become educated and start later. And then once women are as educated as men, then women sexually select for status. So there's not enough high status men to go around. So then they become lesbians or cat ladies or whatever. But among men, it's not necessarily as pronounced. In Finland in the 70s, there was still a positive correlation between how many children you had and socioeconomic status among men. But I wonder if there's certain unique things to Scandinavia. For example, they have a capacity to become alcoholics here to a much greater extent than English people. The non-functioning alcoholic, the alcoholic that's such an alcoholic they can't do anything, is quite rare in England, in my experience. When I was a kid, you'd see them congregating on park benches being pissed in South London, and they were almost invariably Scottish. And then when I was a postgraduate at university in Aberdeen, then I saw it, like these groups of old drunks. And you used to see it in Finland as well when I first came here, groups of old drunks. And once you're part of that drunk class, then you're a complete turn.
Were they Scottish as well?
They were all Scottish, yeah. They were all Scottish.
In Finland.
Yes, in Finland. Every country in the world, even like Kazakhstan, has a Scottish drunk. Oh, no, I think it's that if you're a man and you become a non-functioning alcoholic, then you become Scottish. That is why the Scottish population is increasing. One day, if he becomes alcoholic enough, maybe even Hamza Yusuf could become Scottish.
Well, there's his path to citizenship.
He's not supposed to drink, so because I mean, there is that guy, there's that Muslim guy. I can't remember his name, but he's like a Glasgow Rangers football hooligan, and he's Muslim. You know the guy I mean? And he's been banned from like every pub in Glasgow or every pub in the Catholic area, the Celtic area of Glasgow anyway, because he's just this, and he just goes around singing sectarian songs and getting into fights. He's a sort of local celebrity. Yeah, he really is trying to be as Scottish as he can be. He's Pakistani.
Larping,
kind of. But he's really good at it. I mean, I've seen interviews with him. And talking to him, I think he was involved in the Scottish Defence League as well. and things like that. But yeah, that is so there are some nuances to this. There are some studies that indicate that the relationship, the negative relationship with intelligence and fertility, is not there, at least among men. But among women it is, and we know it's having the impact. We know because the population prevalence of alleles, of polymorphisms that are associated with intelligence, is decreasing across time. And the heritability, so in Iceland, for example, it's decreased across three generations. And now we've got data from England, same thing. And those polymorphisms are correlated with health. So it's a genetic relationship. We're becoming genetically stupider and genetically less healthy, which is why something has to hit in to save us. And I propose that may well be woke eugenics.
Well, because obviously, if it just goes on like this, we're simply going to become a race of retards. I mean,
and
die off. So it's like a reaction to a phenomenon that has reached a certain threshold. So there has to be a reaction, otherwise it will take over the whole thing.
There's a sociological dimension to that as well, which is that we have these five moral foundations. Conservatives are about the same in all five: in-group loyalty, obedience to authority, sanctity versus disgust, equality and harm avoidance. Liberals are only have the two, really. They're motivated by equality and harm avoidance, and also they're mentally unstable. So when I say they're motivated by it, I mean that it interests them. I don't mean that they necessarily are not hypocritical. I mean that it's what they focus on for their own reasons, because it helps them get status. And eventually you would get a point where the needs of the majority of the population in terms of the group-oriented values are not met. You get chaos. And it would come up against something. It would come up against a war or a disease which would force you to be group-oriented. And so I think it went on, this being individually oriented. And then AIDS came along. And this made people more group-oriented for a bit. And then that went away. And the Cold War went away. And so you could get this runaway individualism until it comes up against a wall, or until so many people are dissatisfied that it's like a pressure cooker. And you can look around and just notice, like the Ceausescu revolt in the crowd in Christmas 89. And they could just sort of tell that we all lost faith in him without it needing to be said. And you get that. That's the herd moving, that kind of idea. So, yeah, I think there is that element to it as well.
All right. Here's a rumble rant. Hey, Ed, what sort of food is available at the Jolly Heretic Public House during the holiday season?
Is that a metaphor for what am I doing over the next week?
Yes, I think so.
I might be. I'm probably not going to live stream tomorrow night. And then I'm going to, I'll be live streaming next week, and I may put out I may make a video tomorrow or something. It depends on how things pan out with this Saudi Arabian doctor, who frankly may well have had a reversion to Islam at the last minute. Who knows? I believe it's known as well, what was the word? I wrote it down. Turuk or something? Turay? But this idea
you,
that you...
You mean in Magdeburg, the...
Takia. It's called Takia.
Yeah,
so you pretend that you're not a Muslim when really you are, but I suspect that there's a lot they're not telling us, and apparently so I might do something on that, and then there'll be my usual sherry and Christmas poem, which will come out on Christmas Day, and then normal service will be resumed the following Monday. But I'll do a few things, because I'm going to go to Lapland where my sister-in-law lives, to northern Lapland. But the thing is, all the Finns, the people, they'll all want to go skiing and stuff. And I don't do that. I just don't. I'm not going to break my legs.
I can't quite imagine you skiing.
I put the skis on and everything, and then it just doesn't work. So I'm not doing that. So that's what they'll all go and do. Driving the snowmobile, I'll do that. That's a right laugh. But I've done that. That's great. But the skiing, I'm not so interested in. So if they go and do that, I'll probably sit in the cottage and write something.
Write about Jonathan Bowden, maybe.
Well, I've pretty much finished that. I'm just waiting on this person I know whose father was the Stockport organizer for the BNP and knew him. And then I'm also waiting on getting his grandmother's will, And then I've pretty much finished it. But yeah, it's fascinating guy. And he was a fantasist. I mean, he had many good qualities to him. But he was the charismatic type. Like Hitler was a bit like this. So he was Hitler financially was a complete drifter, total drifter. He was talented. He was an artist, as was Bowden. Bit of a dropout, no qualifications, meanders around, no bloody money. And then somehow his talent for speaking, for oratory, is found. And then off he goes. And with Bowden, unfortunately, that talent only became clear towards the end of his life. And then he suddenly died at 49. But he was an interesting thing. He never seemed to actually work. He never really did a job. He just lived off his dad, I think, or invested. His dad was a bank manager and invested inheritance. Never really had a girlfriend. He would exaggerate things and tell all kinds of lies about being a millionaire or having a wife and five kids. It's all untrue. He's a fantasist. But then there's that is not surprising to me. If you look at a lot of these people that are these charismatic leaders, that's exactly what they are, fantasists. That's exactly what they are.
Why? What was the connection? I mean, why?
Well, if you a lot of the time, these people that are charismatic leaders are narcissists. What is it that causes narcissism? It is often that you have relatively low agreeableness, relatively low conscientiousness, which makes you creative, by the way. Both those things make you creative. And you have relatively high neuroticism. That makes you creative as well. And if it's very high, and if you're traumatized and things like this, then one of the ways you deal with that is by creating a kind of narcissistic false self where you're perfect and you're wonderful and you're grandiose and you're entitled. And you need the narcissistic supply of people applauding you and whatever. And so there's a strong incentive to become a good speaker. Also, being a good speaker, you've got to make jokes, things like that. You've got to be creative and witty, which, of course, he was. If you can tell yourself that you're wonderful, then that confidence will ooze across to the audience. So that's, again, relevant to narcissism and ultimately to being a fantasist, to telling yourself things that are not true, i.e. that you're perfect and you're great, such that it comes across to others and such that you can kind of warm up their world. You can take what is them a cold world and make it seem warm again. That's what the charismatic does. But there is a degree to which he has a fantasy view of himself, and you can see how that would then relate to other things that he would say. He would always try and put himself in a positive, powerful kind of light, and that would cross over with lying. Also, if you've got poor impulse control, which is associated with creativity because you don't follow the rules, you can think outside the box, things like this, well, it's just easier to lie. If people lie all the time, we all tell about three lies a day. If you have poor impulse control, you can't control your urge to lie, so you will tell more lies. So I think that's another factor. And you will reassure yourself if you're mentally unstable and the world is this swirling horrible chaos for you, then fantasy allows you to reassure yourself. It allows you to have a weak sense of self. Your concept of who you are, if you're neurotic, is always changing. You're anxious all the time. So who are you? Oh, yeah, I'm this. This is who I am. Yeah, I'm this. This is what I am. Oh, God, breakdown. Maybe I'm not that. Maybe I'm this all the time. And then when you do that, then you will want your reality to be congruent, to be consistent. You don't want cognitive dissonance. And so you will try to persuade yourself of the veracity of lies such that at any given time you have a consistent worldview where your world seems to make sense. So I think that's relevant to it as well. And then it's just that if you're neurotic, the level of white matter in a certain part of the brain is less. So again, you end up more prone to fantasy. And finally, the other element to it, to being a good speaker, is that you dissociate, a bit like fugue in music. You can enter a kind of alternative consciousness in which you're aware of minutiae and you can, you're almost like playing the room like a piano. And people that are highly mentally unstable will deal with trauma and things by dissociating. They become used to dissociating. They become good at it. And you notice with Bowden as well, is that he changes across time. When people that talk about him that I've met that knew him in the late 80s, I was talking to a guy the other day that used to be a researcher for Michael Portillo. In fact, Michael Portillo I've corresponded with in order to do this book. And they're saying that They can't believe it. What they didn't know about Bowden. They haven't known anything about Bowden since 1991. And then I get in touch and they Google Bowden and suddenly he's this amazing speaker and he's, you know, holding the audience to the palm of his hand. What? The Bowden they knew was this nervous, antisocial, quiet, shy little person. So you could, and that, I mean, that kind of brings in autism, I think, as well, which is associated with mental instability and neuroticism, because you get better with age at learning the things to say and learning how to deal with people and then and learning a persona. And also with mental instability goes down with age as well. And so you get better at sort of holding it in and but they're late developers and he was a very late developer. Had he lived longer, I reckon he would now, you can imagine that he would be this amazing charismatic figure and he'd be earning money and you could imagine him on YouTube. He was born for YouTube. He was born to be on something like this.
Oh, that, absolutely. But, I mean, I think, you know, I like to think he would be a yearly guest on Millennial, for example. But I think beyond that, he would be, I think, a huge figure.
He'd have a Substack. He'd have everything. He'd be a huge internet figure. But unfortunately, and there are people that he's a kind of age that are doing quite well in those spheres. But he died at 49, and that was that. And I looked into it. I mean, everything. So much that's said about him is wrong. It was fascinating looking into it. It's so much. I won't give away everything in the book, but it's extraordinary. His mother's side of the family was the most dysfunctional thing. I traced it back about four generations. I've never seen, you go through the newspapers, you know, just these mentals. His grandmother on the 1921 census was living with her grandmother. Why? Well, because her mother was in prison. And then that grandmother had herself been in prison about 10 times. I mean, it really is. So you get on the one hand, on his father's side, very high intelligence, bank manager, you know, whatever, you're a very intelligent guy, obviously the father. And his mother's side, they're crazy. And those two things come together, the crazy and the intelligent. And that's what the kind of charismatic is, really. He's basically the optimum balance of intelligence and being mental. And that's what I think Bowden kind of was. So yeah, I'm just finishing it. I'm just waiting for a couple of things. And it's a fascinating thing to do. But they asked me to do it in 2019 because I'd already done a book about J. Philippe Rushton and a book about Winston Churchill's prep school headmaster. So I'm known for doing biographies. But somebody else was apparently doing it, and he'd been doing it since 2012. And then by 2021, he still hadn't done it. And I just thought, well, I'll do it. So it's taken me 3 months. It's a very interesting guy. You didn't know him, no?
No, he died just before I made my debut, as it were, like a year before. Okay. I think he died in April 2012 or sometime in 2012. Sure.
March 2012 he died.
March 2012. And I started putting up videos in January 2014. So about 2 years. And I was aware of him before that because I was listening to podcasts and stuff with Spencer. I remember did quite a few with them on the Radix. What was it called? I think it was Radix. I'm fairly sure that Greg did a few with them. I must have known about him before I started, but and you know, undoubtedly we would have been in touch fairly soon. You know, it took about a year after I started before I was in touch with Greg and Jared.
Greg has written the foreword for my book.
Right.
And also he's been very useful because he's kept this thing called the Jonathan Bowden Archive, where all of the speeches have been transcribed. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them have been transcribed and things like this. So it's an extraordinary guy, born posthumously. Nietzsche said that some men are born posthumously. And you see all these videos on YouTube of Bowden's speeches with music in the background and stuff like this, and he's definitely an example of that. I mean, he's been dead for it's 2012. It doesn't seem it's only 12 years ago, but so much has changed in terms of the internet and whatever in that time. But it just seems like another world, really. And then it was fascinating, like, going into it, and you're realizing. I said to the guy, how did you meet Jonathan Bowden? He said, oh, Jonathan Bowden put a classified ad in the back of the Spectator about revolutionary conservatism. He put his phone number there and I rang him up. That's what people used to do in those days. It's crazy, really, if you think about it. But that was how it was.
Yeah.
Word of mouth.
The quote that always gets me is the one about the famous one that everyone shares around about the Albanian on a motorbike will bring you a pizza at 3 a.m. And I think, well, that's, he must have said that around 2010. And I'm presuming that was before Deliveroo and Uber Eats. I don't know if it was there in, let's say he said that in early 2012, then that, you know, it's cutting edge because it's still,
it was incredible the things he got right about the internet as well. There's a bit in one of his, I think it was an interview he did. It was a question and answer session he did, which was published as something like The West Bites Back or something. And he is incredible how much he correctly predicted about how the internet was going to work over the coming decades. Completely right. As you see, he himself said that people that are brilliant in one area are completely useless in another. And he said that the genius is like special needs, but the other way around. And this is true with him, that with the being a polymath and being an autodidact and being a brilliant speaker and all this stuff. He was great. But then with anything practical, and I've interviewed loads of people for the book, and they all say the same thing. Anything practical, he was, of course, completely useless. Anything practical at all. And he never had any money. But it's almost like apparently his dad got him some job in the bank in Wokingham, and he lasted a couple of days. And then from what I can work out, he just never really works. And I don't know, I wonder at what age. Imagine if you have a child. You got a bit of money, and it's a son as well. At what age do you conclude that he's never ever going to work and just give him a small allowance like he's Bertie Wooster but much poorer? Because that's what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. That's 25, 30.
And I got his father's will, and his father died in the same year as he did. His father died just a few months after he did, and it's interesting that he only left him £5,000, and. The reason for that is obvious. It's because he was funding him basically throughout his life. He's got living, step relatives. His stepmother is alive. She's on Facebook. She's 80 something. She won't write back. His stepkids, his stepbrothers, sorry, insist I've written, they won't write back. So there's a lot of sort of tension and things, which would be consistent with the fact that he never works and he just, you know, lived off his dad. So I don't know what he'd have done when his dad died. If he just survived his dad, I wonder what he'd have done for income.
Well, let's hope he would have been practical enough to set up a PayPal account and a Patreon and all that, and then he'd have been fucking fine.
But then he'd have been chucked off those, wouldn't he? So,
well, yeah, maybe. After a few years, after about 5 years, he would have been. But then you've got Subscribestar. I think he would have been fine if he'd made it into this era.
If he'd made it into the zoo, if only he had, yeah, he would have been okay. But unfortunately, he didn't. And he lived in this little caravan, the caravan park in Reading. It was falling apart. But no, fascinating guy. So, there, yeah, that's the other thing. I'm just about to finish that. I think a lot of people should quite enjoy it. I was inspired to do it because I was at this meeting of, I won't name the magazine, but should we call it a purple-pilled magazine? You know, sort of, right. they know the truth, but they won't publicly go there.
Right, sort of, yes.
And I got talking to this particular female journalist who'd heard of me, and I said, "So I know who you are," she said. I was like, "Okay," and then she retrieved from her handbag a copy of a book of Jonathan Bowden's speeches, and looked at me in a coquettish fashion, as if to say, "Hey Ed, hey, bet you didn't think I had it in me." And I thought, bloody hell, if someone as prominent and as overtly purple-pilled as you carries around a book of Jonathan Bowden's speeches in their handbag, then he must
I hope
be
you said to her something like, "Why, you little coquette."
I wish I had. I was too shocked. I wish I said, you naughty little girl. You have to be punished. But no, I didn't. So then I thought, yeah, I'm going to write this book. I'm going to do it. If he's that well known and that influential, then he's the shaman of the radical right, I suppose. Then I think I'm going to go for it. So that's what I did. So yeah.
Were you ever in contact with him? Did you ever meet him?
No, I hadn't. I first heard of him in 2015, I was at the London Conference on Intelligence, and a few people had come along, not as speakers, but as ticket holders, that were in that sort of social milieu of the New Right Forum and things like this. And I overheard a colleague of mine talking with one of these chaps about Baum. That's when I first heard him. It would have been about May 2015. And then I went home and I started, people had also been talking about Julius Evola. And so I thought, well, all right. So I put him into YouTube, found him. I don't think I even knew he was dead at this point. And I thought, wow, this guy's a bloody good speaker that seems to know a lot about all kinds of obscure topics. This is pretty interesting, isn't it? And then I discovered, I couldn't believe it, that he was dead at 49, that he died a few years earlier. And then I just started looking into more of the speeches, and the content is interesting. Particularly, there was one that he did about Punch and Judy, and I knew nothing of this. So these recondite areas of knowledge that he's looked at in kind of autistic detail and knows everything about and knows aspects of it that nobody else would know, and the breadth of knowledge, and it was quite extraordinary, really. So then I became interested in him. And then, as I say, I would call myself the world's expert on Jonathan Bowden. I feel that nobody knows as much about Jonathan Bowden as me, having spent the last 3 months interviewing all his old friends. There's a gap, though. It's like with Jesus. It's like with Jesus in two ways. First of all, there's the Christ of faith and the historical Christ. And I'm afraid we have the same thing with Bowden. There's the Bowden of faith. Some people will be annoyed by this book because it's going to reveal his feet of clay or whatever, however you want to put it. But I don't think they should be, because, as I said, I would be surprised if a charismatic like that did not have this fantasist kind of side to him. But anyway, so there's that. And there's also the missing years. So Jesus has these missing years. He just emerges and off he goes, right? And it's the same with Bowden, the 80s. It's just unclear because it's been delayed. So people that could have told me about this are dead. And also because his stepmother just won't, and step-siblings just won't write back. I don't know anything about his childhood. And the 80s is this weird time where he drops out of various universities and things like this.
It's funny. I've had a similar experience. I was writing earlier this year and last year about a black activist, and I don't really know why exactly it piqued my interest, but it did. And I saw him in a documentary about the Looney Left, and I thought to myself, like, because it's various figures who appear in this documentary, and it's mostly just people who happen to agree to appear in this documentary in 1986, and I thought, how much can I find out about each one of these people? Just to set myself that, just out of curiosity. Yeah. And in some cases, you can actually find out an awful lot, because you find out that they were in the newspapers a lot at that time, in like the mid-80s, because they were political figures, they were active, they were activists. So, but in this particular case, this black activist, Cuba Assegai, he was a hell of a character, and really all over the place. And he appeared in the papers then, but also 10 years earlier in the mid-70s for causing trouble in Birmingham. But in the meantime, before the mid-70s, there's really not much about him at all. And then between those, the mid-70s and the mid-80s, it's empty. He wasn't doing anything that brought him into the newspapers. Therefore, there's no record of what he was doing. And yeah, so I've had a similar experience where there's this gap in a person's biography and you just don't know what to say about that bit. It's very annoying.
It can only be filled in by somehow tracking down people that knew him, which is at once easier and at once more difficult, because it's easier in the sense that you can go to Facebook and you can sort of find people that way. Although often people don't respond to Facebook messages from people they're not Facebook friends with. But if you can find a person that knows them and who you can then get in touch with, I've done this. This is how I track down a number of these people. I found them on Facebook. I thought, right, who are you friends with? Oh yeah, him. Oh, who's he friends with? Oh, him. I know him. And then I get in touch with that person. But then the other is that what I would have done in the good old days, when I was, if I was trying to get in touch with his stepmom, for example, is I'd have just gone to the library and got the phone book and gone through the phone book and just rung her up. And her number would likely have been in the phone book as well. And now you can't do that. That's not a possibility. It's not there. What do you do? So it's a real bugger that. Why can't there just be? It was free. I mean, they deliver it for free, the phone book. Okay, for only for your local area. But if you wanted all phone books in the country, you just go to the largest library in your borough, and they were there. And likewise, Who's Who was there for free in the library. Not anymore.
Facebook has taken over a lot of this, but as you say, people can simply not reply if they're not interested. And I mean, that's their right, but it's bloody annoying as a researcher because the thing, and this is something you'll have found as well, that somebody, the person you are trying to contact this Wednesday might be the only person who has the information that you want. So if you don't get to them and get that information and record it, it will simply not be recorded and it will be lost forever. It's kind of like information is precious because it might be restricted to just one person.
Yeah,
or the other one died last year, kind of thing.
Exactly. His mother's side, the poorer side, I've worked out that through using the Mormon genealogy website, that his aunt or half aunt on his mother's side had 7 children. And then I've worked out who the daughters were married to. But they've been incredibly hard to track down. I've worked out that one of them, I can't get hold of any of them because the surname's too common. It's Clay. And so it's very difficult. I've managed to find his cousin on his father's side, and she seems to be married to a vet in Cornwall. So I've written to the veterinary surgery and asked, look, is your wife this woman who's Jonathan Bowden's cousin?
And this is the thing, because they can always think, yeah, they can receive that letter and think, well, what the hell's this? What business is it of yours who my wife is? And why are you stalking her and all this? Whereas it's actually a perfectly innocent inquiry, but it seems like stalking.
It seems to people that are involved in writing and research and things like that, particularly. And with him, I've got my high hopes in that he's aware, he's educated, intelligent. Maybe he'll understand the value of what I'm doing. But with some people, you're like, yeah, hang on, you're coming in there asking all these questions about us, family. What business is it of yours? You know. But my deadline with the publisher is the 1st of January, and I might make it a bit. I keep my deadlines. But in this case, I might delay it a bit, just to see if I can get anything else. I just really want to, when you're doing it, you want it to be perfect and you really want to know everything. With him, there are these years where we know nothing. Probably he was basically mentally ill. Ironically, he lived very close to Broadmoor. But I suspect that's what it was.
That's another thing. And maybe you'll have found yourself curious about this as well. And I mean, research, especially if a person's life leads up to, it leads to all these little questions, and it's ideal for someone like you and me who are very curious and randomly curious about things. But one of the questions is, because you say there that he was mentally ill, so then you end up asking, well, where are the records for the mental hospitals in that area? Do they still exist? Were they burned in the mid 2000s or the late 90s or whatever? Or do they still exist somewhere? Could I find out the date when and he was taken in, when he was released? Who did it? What was the diagnosis?
I think they're too recent to be given out. But I did do I did research many years ago, 2011, 2010. The guy that came up with the concept of culture shock. And he turned out to be a Finnish Canadian, and he moved. He was brought up on this island in this kind of Finnish romantic cult, essentially, an island called Suintola off the coast of British Columbia, called Kalerva Oberg. And it turned out his mother had some kind of mental breakdown, and so then I found her death, and I googled what's the place that they put as a place of death, and it was a mental home. And then I got in touch with the mental home, and they sent me all her records, urine tests, everything from about 1930, everything. And like letters that they'd been sent from a husband who was Finnish, who, you know, English was difficult for him, and he'd written these letters saying it breaks his heart to see her like this, and everything they have, huge bundle of stuff for free, which is very good of them. And it's when you're curious, and then you see them, you're like, I wonder what's the cause of that. I wonder that. Like little things. Like I noticed in his speeches, he talked about Polytechnic of North London. And I thought, well, was it? Why? Why are you mentioning that? And then I found a name. He named a lecturer that he knew that was at that Polytechnic. I got in touch with him. And he said, oh, yeah, I remember Bowden. Yeah, he used to sit right at the front in about 1984. Yeah, short, chubby guy with a beard. Yeah, I remember him, yeah. And I got to know him, and we used to have lunch together and blah, 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 blah. And I got that because he mentioned in his speech, he named this particular left-wing Marxist academic.
And that's a good example of how a piece of information can so tenuously be preserved, because he could have just not mentioned him, or he could have named someone else, or he could have been talking about a different topic, or someone might have coughed in the room and distracted them at that moment, whatever. But none of that happened. So he did mention that name. So you were able to get that.
And then I have that extra piece of information. And the thing is, there are many speeches by him that haven't been published, that remain as VHS cassettes in a house somewhere in Cheshire. I just think to myself, how can I publish this book having not seen them? I've got to get hold of them. I've got to surely... I don't want to have to do a second edition.
Maybe that's a good idea, though. Maybe you should do it, because that the first edition might well bring people in who can then help you, who knew him.
Well, this has happened in Twitter as well. So I mentioned in an interview that I did with a guy that you're interviewing soon called this distributist. I mentioned in an interview with him because I referred to that philosophy in my book. But, of course, I call it distribution. Anyway, I spelled it wrong. And then I realized that talking to him, distributionism or something. And then because I mentioned it, someone tweeted out, Ed Dutton is doing a biography of Jonathan Bowden. Someone that calls himself, you know, Jonathan Bowden's ghost or something on Twitter. And then he put me in touch with somebody else that had done some of the genealogical research I'd done. And he gave me an idea about something, which I put in the book, and then he put me in touch with someone else. And so, yeah, so if you're watching and you knew Jonathan Bowden, or get in touch. You've got about a week before I send the thing off to the publisher. So get in touch and let me know anything you know. I'd be most grateful. Because, it's absolutely, and his influence just seems to grow and grow. And the people that I've got in touch with, to a man, not the people that were in the BNP or whatever, they've kept in touch with what's going on, but the people that from when he was much younger, as I say, not just a number of them have remarked on this, that, hang on, what? Jonathan Bowden? I spoke to his school science teacher, who's still alive, and he's about 85, and or 80, and he remembered him, and he went, oh, yeah, I remember, yeah, sort of short, tubby physiognomy, I remember him, yeah, shy, didn't have any friends. I remember him. Yeah. What you're telling me, he is a great, charismatic far right. Oh, no, really, and all this sort of stuff. You know, the people that haven't seen him since 1980, and then suddenly this has happened, and they're so shocked by it. It's like he's a completely different person from the person they knew. So what happened in the end with your thing on this black fellow? Did you publish this?
No, not yet. I've not finished it yet. I wrote, I think it came out, it's 16,000 words just now. It'll probably be about 22,000 when it's finished.
It's a mini book. I mean, what fascinated you so much about this obscure black activist that I've never heard of?
I don't know. That's the thing. This is why I wrote it right after Last Millennial. I got into this and I was wondering throughout it, why am I doing this? And I don't really know. I guess it's interesting to see it from the other perspective. You know, he was an identitarian, but he was a black identitarian, and he had admiration for Hitler of all people. But apart from that, I don't think he had a good thing to say about a single white person. He just hated them. And it seems like his whole life was this. It was dedicated to And he lived in he moved to Birmingham from a Caribbean island, St. Kitts. He moved from there to Birmingham in about 1953. He was one of very, very, very few black people in Birmingham. He was a child, obviously. And he was, you know, he felt out of place. And it seems that in the late 60s, so he felt inferior to white people. And he says that. There's one single quote I was able to find where he says this. That he for a long time I hated myself for being black. But then in the late 60s, he got radicalized, Black Panthers and all this. And thereafter, he was just, the rest of his life, he had a huge vendetta that he was enacting against white people with various political activism. And eventually fled the country. He had to flee Britain because he had threatened to kill someone. And he thought that they were going to put him in prison for a long time. So he fled.
Is he still alive?
He died in 2020. So that's my fucking regret. That I wish I had thought to do this like 4 years earlier and I would have been able to interview him. Now, and that's a good question as well. Would he have talked to me? Maybe, because I was honest with him, I would be the one white person he would talk to. I don't know.
I think these kinds of people have these dark triad traits. It sounds like he does. And so I think.
Oh, yeah, that's one thing. I thought about consulting you about this, actually, because I do think he was sociopathic in that he lied and lied and lied about everything. Even when it was obvious that he would be found out, this kind of thing. For example, he called himself a doctor, but I contacted the universities and they'd never heard of him.
Yeah, Bowden would, when Bowden joined the Monday Club, he stated on his application that he had to do, a master's degree from Cambridge University, and he was doing a PhD at the University of London on Wyndham Lewis. So, of course, they contacted Cambridge University, and his tutor, who I've also got in touch with, he's about 90 now, but his tutor wrote back, this is in 1991, I have a copy of the letter, saying that Mr. Bowden was my tutee. He was here between October 1988 and February 1989 or something like this. I don't feel I can tell you anything else without his permission. And then they got in touch with the school and they got his O levels, but they didn't get his A levels because he failed his A levels. And then went to a sixth form college to do different A levels, which he did very well in. But of course, he didn't tell them he'd been to the sixth form college. So they then concluded that maybe he'd like had fake A level certificates or something like this, and this was how he got into Cambridge, which I then asked them about, and then they gave me his A level results and said no, there was no fakery involved. So it is fact, and there'd be so much more now if you were doing a contemporary figure. There'd be all these YouTube videos and things on archive.org and tweets, all this stuff. Whereas with these people, there's just these periods where there's absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm trying to imagine what he did. One of the things he seemed to do was just go along to local universities and go to lectures. Imagine you've only got the library, no internet. How do you pass the time? If he was in Reading, he'd go along to Reading University and go to some geography lectures. Or he'd go along to the Polytechnic of North London and go to some literature lectures. Or he'd go along to Manchester University and go to some engineering lectures. But then he'd tell people, oh, yeah, I studied engineering at Manchester. I studied geography at Reading, I studied English literature, which is not true, is it? But it's an exaggeration. It's all of these, never a self-effacing fib, always in a kind of exaggeration.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. The guy that I was writing about, someone's saying that's not a book. No, it's a mini book. I didn't use the word book.
I said small book.
Exactly. It would be like a novella, I guess.
That word entered my mind, actually, a novella.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not supposed to. I mean, it's an essay. It's for Substack. That's what it's designed as. It just ended up being a lot longer than I envisaged. But I did get a friend to read it, and as it is currently, and he said he loved it. And even though I don't really know why I'm writing it, that's the thing. So, yeah, I mean, all of the, I could talk for ages about the work of research, the job of it, the tasks of it, because it is a very interesting thing to be into. It
is. I mean, years ago, people have heard of Jonathan Bowden, obviously, and nobody has pretty much heard of your figure as far as I can work out. So it's more similar. It reminds me of when I wrote my book Churchill's Headmaster on Churchill's prep school headmaster. And that was inspired by reading about World War II revisionism in terms of that Churchill actually was just this alcoholic, this really quite unpleasant person and all this sort of stuff, and warmonger and all this. And so that this got me thinking, well, hang on, if these are all lies about Churchill, maybe what they've said about his headmaster at prep school being this evil sadist, whatever, maybe that's not true either. And this is a guy, he died at 38, Herbert Snaith Kinsley. And then suddenly there I am researching him. And it started off as a little essay. It started off as 6,000 words or something, I thought, in terms of a paper. And then eventually it became a sort of 80,000 word book on everything about this guy and his life and times. And then I was able to get in touch with people that were the descendants of his pupils.
Right.
So there was a guy that died recently called Peter Jay. He married Jim Callahan's daughter, and he was the British ambassador to America when he was only aged about 40. He died about a month ago. And I worked out from his father was a Labour cabinet minister. And then in his father's memoirs, it referred to how his father's father had been a pupil at that school, at St. George's Ascot, under Snaith Kinsley. So then I got in touch with him. And then he had his cousin, who was a peer of the realm, Lord Jay of Ulm, had his grandfather, who died in 1950s, diaries from when he was a child, and sent them to me. And then suddenly I've got the diaries written at the time, while he's at school. Yeah, this happened on this day, and there wasn't much flogging, I have to tell you. And so these sorts of things, it's quite interesting. can occur, yeah. And
then amazing. I don't know what to say. That it's just it's so interesting how something that is obscure can end up being interesting. As I say, I only hope that when I do publish this essay, at least someone finds it interesting.
What was his name again? This guy,
Cuba with a K, Assegai, A S S E G A I, and he called himself a doctor. I'm pretty sure that was completely that he was never even. He claimed to have got a doctorate from Cranbrook. I can't remember what it's called. Institute of Technology. I contacted them. They'd never heard of him. So,
yeah. I think that's how a university, yeah. Isn't it? Cranbrook, isn't it a university? Cranbrook, yeah, it's.
Yes, it is. It started off as, I think it started off as an Institute of Technology. That's what it was called. This is all early, at the start of this year that I was researching this. It's not razor sharp in my memory. But yeah, I would like to return to that. It's part of the Loony Left project that I was doing, or am doing. Right. It's just so big and sprawling. Like that essay alone has ended up being, as I say, huge. So, and the thing is, the interesting thing, and you'll relate to this, is that you get a notion of how long something lasts, how long a life is, because somebody who was active in the 70s might well be dead now. It probably is dead now. Someone who was active in the 80s might well be dead now. So it becomes quite limited.
Well, you get some people that they're active when they're very young. And then they stop being politically involved. A good example is Martin Webster, who I've interviewed on my channel. And he was national organizer for the National Front, essentially the co-leader of the National Front between about 1972 and 1980, apart from a brief break where they lost control of somebody else. And then he just stopped being involved in politics. And by that stage, he was only about 37. So he was 37 and he just stops. He's in the news all the time. He's on TV and then he just stops. And runs a bookshop. And then he's still alive. I've been for dinner with him. And it's, but and he did everything significant in his life up to the age of between about the age of 1964, so 21, between the age of 21 and 37. 21, he was first in the papers because he ran up to Yomo Kenyatta and beat him up in the street. And then it was in the papers pretty much continuously after that, till he's 37, and then it's just ended. Nothing, just nothing.
Yeah. It's as if they just sort of exit history at that point. There's no longer any record of what they did then. So it's like they just disappeared.
Yeah, and there's nothing. Absolutely no twist, nothing. And he just makes, like, also like he's made a conscious decision. Yeah, I don't want to be famous anymore. And in those days, you could do that because there wasn't the internet. Nobody could Google you. So even if you've been leader of the National Front, you still wouldn't necessarily have trouble getting a job. I think there was a case, actually, of some guy, I forget his name, but he was a member of parliament, a very controversial, but not very famous, but like he was controversial briefly. Something weird happened. I forget what the details were, in the 70s. And then by the 80s, he was a taxi driver. And he used to be, a Labour MP. And you could do that then. But now,
yeah, because in order to find out your history, somebody would have to go to the library, a big library, and look through microfiche of old newspapers. I mean, it's completely different from nowadays when you can just either Google them or look on a newspaper archive website, and there are only two notable ones of those. So it's all very centralized now.
It's worse. We used to talk about, oh, there's bad publicity about you, don't worry, it's tomorrow's chip paper. But A, we don't wrap fish and chips in newspaper anymore. We wrap it in plain paper. And B, it's not tomorrow's chip paper because it's there forever. So maybe we should think about that. That's a problem. Maybe we should make it literally more difficult to access this stuff. Maybe we should go back to a situation where you have to go in person. I mean, I wouldn't be able to write my book. Obviously, it'd be a bit of a bugger. But you can see from a sort of ethical perspective, it's a bit of an issue. It's a bit of something that was fine. It was fine. You're in the newspapers. You, for example, Bowden's stepsister in, when was it now? Maybe 1991, when she was 21 years old, she was done for reckless driving and fined £150 plus £15 costs. Now, at the time, she's in the paper, it's a bit embarrassing, it's in the local paper, and that's the end of it, and no one knows anything else. And now I know that. That's there on the British newspaper website. That's there forever, that she was an impetuous young girl. It's rather unfair, really, because the whole...
It is. It is. I mean, people certainly at that age, I think until you're 25, and you can confirm that the brain doesn't fully mature until that around that time, I think a lot of stuff should just be written off. I mean, you know, careless behavior, but that's what kids are like. It's what teenagers are like. It's what early 20s are like. And it's always been that way. I don't know. I'm not saying that they should be let off with blue murder. I'm just saying it should be taken as read that people have a misspent youth.
I've known people, it's just been a bloody hell. If we'd have had the internet as a large, big scale thing when I was 21, like the bollocks that I'd have self-published that would come back to haunt me now. And it's I know of at least two cases of people that were born in late 90s or whatever that have had to change their names, legally change their names, in order to get work, because they've written right wing things on Twitter or whatever when they were students, and then you get some nasty schizo that stalks them and tries to promote what they've done in the past wherever they go, and so consequently they've literally had to change their name. It's absolutely awful for things that if we'd have done them when I was their age, you just couldn't write these things down, you couldn't publish them. It just wasn't possible. And these pile-ons that they get. There was a case I was reading about recently of some woman, some children's author, and she tweeted support for J.K. Rowling saying that men shouldn't be allowed to become women or whatever it was. And because of that, she lost her publishing contract with HarperCollins and lost her agent and had to retrain as a heavy goods driver because of one sharing of a J.K. Rowling tweet. And that happened a month after her husband had just died. So it's quite a stressful period, as you can imagine. So that's it. One tweet, and if there wasn't the tweet to Twitter there, then that. It's the same thing I wonder about with this like Charlie Veach. What he does, I like what he does. Fine, he goes around Manchester and he documents degeneracy. Great, but the thing is that the idea that you could, everyone's got a camera on them, and as long as you're in a public place, they can film you. And that was never a risk in the past. I mean, if someone was able to film you, they had a big camera and you knew about it. But now you can be surreptitiously filmed by this little self-appointed Stasi, because you're a bit drunk on a train and you're saying something regrettable or whatever. I mean, I can see why. I can see the argument for, hang on, that's not on.
See, I was talking with Lichtmess last night about the change in social the tension that seems to exist now that wasn't there in the 90s. Like, just social life was far more relaxed in the 90s. And you're describing why that probably is. It's that we instinctively know, at the back of our minds, we always know everything is being recorded in some way or could be getting recorded in some way. If I say the wrong thing on a train to my friend, if it's overheard, if it's recorded, it could end up on the internet forever. Forever.
Yeah. It's incredible.
I could be 90 and still haunted by this thing I just said.
So I'm saying that I can therefore see the argument for saying that you shouldn't be allowed to film someone, even in a public place, without their consent. I can see the argument. And there are countries that have such laws. And I can see it in a way that it's awful that we get to this point, but it's ridiculous that you have all these people, particularly the young fanatical women, as Orwell said, it's always the women, the noses out of unorthodoxy, that will get offended and get triggered, and they're mentally unstable and highly socially conformist, and it sends them crazy. They can't deal with it. Like that case in Scotland of this the one of the advocates for Alex Salmond. And he was just talking to his advocate friend on the train about the Alex Salmond sexual abuse case. And okay, he shouldn't have been doing that, but he was. And some bastard records him. And then he has to report himself to the whatever the equivalent of the bar council is in Scotland and blah, 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 blah. Just because he's had a bit to drink, basically. And he's chatting to his friend on a train about a case that he's currently doing. So I can see the argument. It would be interesting if we got to that point. Where you just say, no, you can't, because we are in a situation now. I mean, even like my daughter was playing Grand Theft Auto 5 earlier on the PlayStation, and that's 2012 that was made, i.e. when Bowden was alive. And you think, God, there's no trans flags anywhere, and it's a different world. This is going back in time to play Grand Theft Auto, and okay, you're Calvin and you're whatever his name is, Clinton. What's his name? The black guy.
I don't know.
Yeah, you do.
Leroy.
No, I think his surname's Clinton, but I can't remember. Anyway, whatever. You're one of the characters anyway. And okay, you're shooting people up and killing them and stuff, but you can't be filmed. Because in America, that's how you can get away with it. In America, they don't have all these surveillance cameras; it's not allowed, and you haven't got people with mobile phones filming you because it's 2012.
Apparently, it's Franklin.
Franklin, that's it. Yeah, Franklin. Franklin, is it Franklin Clinton? Is that his name? Franklin Clinton. I think that's his name. And Mike, and Trevor. They're bringing out a new one, and apparently it's going to be awful, and there's going to be a female character in it, and it's going to just be rubbish. So I woke GTA.
Let's not get started on that topic. I'm not into video games, but even I know this stuff that they're always injecting this rubbish into.
Yeah, there's this rubbish one, because I saw on YouTube somebody had put up a computer game where you, in a very realistic way, get to tour Victorian London. And I thought, that's interesting. That's interesting to the extent that I want it. So I went and got it. And it's called Syndicate, Assassin's Creed. And I went and got it, and it's nowhere near as good as GTA 5. First of all, there's people trying to kill you all the time. So it's like being in some game from the 90s on the Master System or something, where there's all baddies everywhere. I don't want baddies. I want to be able to just walk around and enjoy the scenery. That's what I want. And then secondly, there's bits where if you walk up to a wall or something, then suddenly it just goes, like you're going into the edge of the world. Well, that's just bad programming. Thirdly, when it started, because they didn't want to make it ridiculous, they didn't want to have like black people in it, although you do have the occasional black person in it. It's 1860, for God's sake, but it's not everywhere. So they actually put a thing at the beginning saying that this game is set in history, but it's been made by a multiracial, diverse cast of people that have various gender identities. At the beginning of the game. Because they couldn't, you know, they had to do that to compensate for the fact that there aren't any black people or gays or transsexuals in the game, because it's set in 1860. I was like, oh, for God's sake. And also, it was so bad, the gameplay. It's so difficult. You know that guy, Callum from the Lotus Eaters? Well, he came and stayed at my house. And because he was born in the late 90s, he's good at computer games. So he got me to the bit where you can just walk around London. Because it starts off in Croydon, for Christ's sake. And you got to make your way on the train from Croydon, which is an awful place, even there, to central London and all these bad guys. Oh, for God's sake. But he was able to do it, so it's good. He's
all right. Well, we were talking about the surveillance, and I think it's... See, on the one hand, I appreciate that things are recorded, because... As we were saying, Jonathan Bowden's life is just in the 80s is just a black hole with no idea. Whereas the 2000s and it's more, there's more information to be recovered, and you can slot that into a biography and a mental map of his life. Good. But on the other hand, the cost of that surveillance is a total loss of privacy and yeah. This permanence of things that once upon a time would simply have been not permanent, they're ephemeral. They'd have been completely forgotten. It's a double-edged sword for sure. Well, we should get to the super chats because we are running out of time. Okay, maybe next time. Said too late to say hello, hello, hello. But is it too late, Ed?
Hello, hello, hello. You know, welcome to the Jolly Heritage. Join me on my pub at 7 p.m. UK time on Mondays.
Excellent. The Silver Tichy says, Ed, what got you from studying divinity to Finland and genetics?
Okay. Well, so when I was studying divinity, I met my now wife, and she was also studying divinity, and she's from Finland. And so then when I finished my PhD, I moved to Finland, and then I moved over from studying religion to studying culture, specifically Finnish culture, and published a book on that. And then I got interested in culture shock and did a book on that. And then I started realizing that genetics was relevant to both of these things, and that the explanations that I had, and religion, that I had theretofore been given were politically motivated and partial. And at about that time, I got to know Richard Lynn. And he started funding me. And so then I was able to just go for it. And so then I started looking at the genetic perspective, which I would argue is much more parsimonious than what I'd previously been taught, which was that everything was to do with environmental stuff. I started researching religion because, like Bowden, as it happens, I was a Protestant at a Catholic school. And so I'm from not a very religious background. And so religion started to fascinate me. And then I went to university as an undergraduate, and there was this fundamentalist Christian group. And I met a lot of friends in that group, but I found them really fascinating. So that's what I did my doctorate on, fundamentalist Christianity. But anyway, now, yeah, that's how I moved into evolutionary psychology and Finland.
All right. Okay, and then is my audio okay, by the way?
Yes. Yes.
Right, okay, because the video is kind of juddering. Okay, Jen et al., posted a very generous super chat, thank you very much, and said, happy holidays, thanks for the streams. Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad you're enjoying them. And then Black Pigeon Pilled, please ask Ed his thoughts on the proper relationship between the dissident right and esotericism. The names René Guénon and Julius Evola loom large, but is it all still postmodernism for Tory spergs? Merry Christmas and good Yule. Fantastic to hear about the Bowden book as well.
I did actually have a section on this, but I cut it down in the Bowden book where I answered the question, is traditionalism basically just postmodernism for conservatives? And my counter-argument, it's often the books are badly written and written in a very opaque way, that you've basically got various assumptions and you go from there. But the way in which it isn't postmodernism for conservatives is, A, what they're espousing is something that is adaptive for the group and for the individual, whereas what postmodernists are espousing is something that's maladaptive. B, based on their first principles, it seems to me that the traditionalists are quite logical, whereas postmodernists are often completely inconsistent. Although postmodernism is quite broad, there are different kinds of postmodernists, some more extreme than others. But it's often not very consistent. So that those who espouse it are not particularly consistent, because they're about basically signalling intelligence, signalling profundity, and trying to play for status. And thirdly, I just think that the nature of the philosophy is completely very, very different. One of them is a philosophy almost of solipsism, which is saying that we are all sparks of divine light. We're all gods that can create ourselves and invent ourselves. Basically, life has no meaning at all. And it's just almost like shouting in a room, and the person that shouts the loudest, they get to write the fictional story that is life or something. That it's this solipsistic philosophy of nihilism, of nothing, whereas the traditionalism is basically the opposite. It's basically it's philosophically justifying the traditional way of doing things, and it's arguing that you're in this hell, this clown world, you should withdraw from it in some way, and that's how you will cope. That's kind of pretty much what they're arguing, and there are various ways in which you can do that. So they're quite different things. I mean, one metaphor that a friend of mine came up with that I put in the book is postmodernism is a girl with purple hair standing there at a university campus shouting about Palestine or transsexuality or whatever. And she feels that she's inventing her own reality and she's the spark of divine light and everyone has to listen to her. That's postmodernism. Traditionalism is that a student stands across the road from her and then just suddenly he's wearing furs and he just grabs her and takes her to the middle of the field and then rips off her clothes and rapes her and then pulls out her still beating heart. That's traditionalism. They're very different. Traditionalism is grounded in the harshness of reality. And it's saying we as a group, in order to survive, have to act in an evolutionarily adaptive manner. And this is it. Whereas that one, the postmodern view, is completely retreating from reality into your own little world of your head, where you can direct your own reality via a kind of magical thinking. They're very different philosophies.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll leave it at that rather than pick up on it. Black Pigeon Pilled also said Bowden's speeches on W.B. Yeats, Wyndham Lewis, and T.S. Eliot were brilliant. I think it was listening to these which first informed me of the London-based occult society Hermetic Order Golden Dawn. I haven't heard of them, but okay, thank you for that. Stephen said, I've been so busy with other studies that I've neglected my internet studies. Because, man, that essay sounds bloody fascinating. I, too, have in the past taken an odd interest in some black identitarians. That'll be a great read. Well, I think he's talking about the one I mentioned. Well, I'll send you the rough draft, Stephen. So thank you for that. Thank you for your interest. Flarecake said, Ed, I just ordered a copy of Woke Eugenics from Amazon. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you. I hope you enjoy it and Merry Christmas.
All right.
Maybe you're going to give it to someone for Christmas. I don't know.
Possibly. Let me just see if there are any additional. I think we've dealt. Yes, we've answered all of those. All right. Okay, so is there anything else you'd like to say about Woke Eugenics or Jonathan Bowden?
I think we've got through everything. So I'll just say to your viewers, if you're new, then I'm on YouTube, Jolly Heretic. Please subscribe. I'm on Substack, Jolly Heretic. Please subscribe. And if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month and so on. And proper beer, not London prices beer, like beer in the provinces. Then my books are all available on Amazon, and my papers you'll find at edwarddutton.com, academic papers. So, yeah, and as I say, I stress, if you knew Bowden or you knew people that knew him, please get in touch, because the worst thing, I mean, I'm sure Woz feels the same thing about his Assegai person, is that you want to know everything. It's got to be complete. You want to know all. Even if you don't include it, you want at least be aware of it. So if you're watching Adam's stepmother, if you're watching Shirley old girl, then, sorry, not Shirley, Sylvia. If you're watching Sylvia, Sylves, if you're watching, please, it's unlikely, but please could you respond to the letter I sent you? I got your address from your husband's will. I know you still live there. Come on. Let's do him justice.
All right. Don't try not to sound too stalkerish and intimidating there, Ed. I know you're asking in the best possible spirit. All right. I hope that Sylvia does contact you. I really do, and many other people too. I'm not. I think you should be open to the idea of doing a second edition, because this is a very important work. Mm. So that's what I would say. All right, let's end it there. So, Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, regular on Millennial. People always look forward to it, and I think this has been a good stream, a good addition to the pantheon. So thank you for appearing.
Pleasure. Merry Christmas.
All right. I will be back imminently with Garrod Murphy, I believe. Yes, it is. So I will see you then. But in the meantime, bye-bye for now.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available, but no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.